It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are adding some sophistication to the world's communication skills. In difficult times, you have to get better at talking, it turns out. And we're being challenged by that. So we're going to do some work on it. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer. I blend worlds, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The podcast, I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. I convert conservatives at times because the right worries me. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians and people who have interesting social issues that they're pushing out into the world. It's super fun to talk to everybody who's trying to use words to get things done. Today's another episode of Persuasion Pros, I guess I would say. My guest is the founder of Mosaic Fusions. I noticed her because she calls herself a human value optimization specialist. And as a rhetorician, I love phrases that are new ways of saying things. So I like that. We're going to talk about it today. She helps leaders to maximize productivity through transformational programs that enable them to recruit, develop, and optimize the value of a mosaic of talent. That's straight from hers. I stole it. From the UK, Susan Popula. Popula?
Popula's fine. Yep.
Is that fine or is it right?
It depends on who's saying it, because I mean, that is an interesting thing to almost start with. It's a Nigerian name. Some people hear it and think it's Greek, or see it and think it's Greek, but it's a Nigerian name. And there's the Nigerian, specifically Yoruba way of pronouncing it. And then there's the English way of pronouncing it, and I typically pronounce it in the English way, except if I go to Nigeria, it makes life easy for me to do my best to pronounce it in the Nigerian way. But going with the English way, Popula, Susan Popula.
All right, what's the Nigerian way sound like?
Well, you need to get the intonations to it, so it's po po ola. Bring that together. And I mean, and I guess the richness of it is that the name, as every other African name, has a meaning. And so Kwokwo is like road, the way. Ola is wealth. So it's the road to wealth.
Really? Well, that's a good starter name for you.
Yeah.
The road to wealth. We have a Nigerian that works on our software team, and his name is God's Power.
Okay.
I don't know if that's his given name or if he grabbed that name for some reason, but it's God's Power for sure. That's what it says.
It could very much be his given name.
That's pretty solid. Usually you hear the name in its original and it'll translate to something like God's Power, like Daniel, my name, I guess, in Hebrew, I guess it's Hebrew, means power of God or wisdom of God. But yeah. In our culture now, it just means Dan.
Yeah. But it's nice to know the meaning of a name, the meaning of things. There's a significance to it. I mean, a name, just thinking about a name, it could be reflective of what was going on at a time in a country or place, or it could be the circumstances that led, I mean, that coming up to a child's birth, or the loss of someone in the family, naming the child after that person, or what have you.
Right.
So names tell stories.
They do.
I have a curiosity about names.
I do too. I find, again, as a rhetorician, the smaller the linguistic diamond, the more interesting in a lot of ways. So words and names, you know, are the smallest holders of meaning. And I get hired by businesses to come in and work on their name, because if you hit the right name, it can change everything.
Yeah.
If you hit the wrong one, it causes confusion for everybody in your organization for all time.
Yeah. So and I guess that's what we now talk about a lot in terms of brand as well. And I mean, it links into brand. It's the name is part of a brand and how an organization is positioned and what it means. And I guess, as you said, getting it wrong can cause an organization a lot of trouble.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny to me, like coming from rhetoric, which the Greeks started studying this stuff 2,500 years ago, and now they call it up here, they call it brand, but in the Greeks called it ethos, which is the character, which everybody uses to quickly know you. Right. And so I have people who always want to translate my stuff back into the business terms. One of the things we do is we sell personal ethos, like build character for people who need to be known in business. And people are like, oh, so brand. I'm like, no, ethos.
Yeah. And it's because I guess you could argue it in different ways, and it depends on what the focus is, because you could argue that your brand is part of your ethos, or vice versa. It depends on the starting point, but no matter how strong your brand is, if it doesn't align to the ethos of the people working within, then there's a problem.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things that, you know, start to become problematic when you move from the linguistic down into the real or the active, you know, so that, you know, are they connected when you talk about yourself? Is that actually who you are? I had this discussion with my son yesterday, who's talking about buying a car, and he was talking about buying a Tesla, which is based pretty close to us where we live in Austin. And then he had talked to some guy who really knew cars, and the guy's like, oh, Teslas are junk. And I'm okay. Like, yeah, so are you buying the marketing of Tesla, or are you buying the real information about Tesla? Because you don't have the real information, just that guy seems to have it.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, because when I work with organizations, I love to sit down with the chief executive or senior leadership team and find out what they believe, what their beliefs are about their organization, what they say they stand for, what their values are, because these days everyone's talking about our values and identifying our values. And it's always interesting to hear what they say. And sometimes I get quite excited by what they have to say. But what I always like to do is have a random conversation with people that work for them and find out what they have to say. And does it align? Because if it doesn't align, then there's a problem. That's the real test what you're buying, huh?
Yeah. So take us through, give us a little bit of your background. So explain to people what you do and who you are and where you came from and all that good stuff.
Gosh, that's a big question.
Right? But... it's a huge question. I'm going to hit you with the biggest question ever. And the meaning of life. Tell me that.
Okay.
Too.
To some extent, what I do, who I am and what I do, they link together. I am one of those deep thinkers, so it's all connected. So I was born in England. My parents are Nigerian. And from when I was small, I was always taught, I had the belief in human value. Everyone has value. That's what my mum taught me.
That sounds like a... like there are certain things that come out of certain cultures in certain ways. And that seems like an African or a Nigerian belief structure, that like this universal value of humanity and things like that. Do you think that came from Nigeria?
Well, it's interesting you say it's universal, because it's something that has, should I say it, through my life, it's British and it is Nigerian as well.
Okay.
So my influences are much wider than that, but just starting off, there is the British influence that brings that to bear. There is also the Nigerian influence that reinforces that as well. But the key is, I was taught everyone is important, everyone has a value. It doesn't matter who they are, it doesn't matter what they do, whether it's a leader of a company or whether it's someone that is cleaning a building or what have you, anything else. And I think the pandemic has demonstrated that across the world in terms of who really kept things going, who had to go out to work while people like myself were sitting down working from home. And so that belief in humanity and people has always permeated. It's followed me around. I haven't been able to get rid of it. And so with that view, one of the things why I talk about human value optimization is I believe everyone's value, to realize it, an individual needs to recognize the value that they have and what they have to offer. If they don't recognize it, then it's limited. But also the people around them need to recognize it as well, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in education, or whether it's in wider society. And it's when those two come together that people's value is optimized, hence human value optimization. And there are a few things that I do with that. So my work with organizations, Mosaic Fusions, as you just mentioned, that is really working with organizations, helping them to develop. I talk about Mosaic because there is that rich diversity of people.
Yeah, that's a cool offerings. Word. That's a nice word yeah. You grabbed.
But then when you, but specifically going beyond diversity, that diversity is only its value is only realized when people work together, common purpose, common interests, common ethos, dare I say, which is like glue that binds the pieces together to create something rich and colorful and beautiful and effective. And so that's the work I do with organizations. I also do work with young people, and I talk about Mosaic Wise because they're wise to who they are and the value that they have to offer. And then I do, a bit of writing alongside, and I've written a few books as well. And so I guess for a long time, journeying through life, the focus was, there was a bread and butter work within organizations, human resources, organization development, focus around people. But with that approach of these are people that have value, optimize that value, not that they're widgets and how do we use them. But while doing that, I've always had an involvement in wider society from England. I've been to Nigeria, lived in Nigeria, come back to England, traveled to different parts of the world. And I've always had an interest in that human side, what's going on. So I've been like a youth worker. I've done prison visits. I've been on the school board. I visited Haiti after the earthquake, visited New Orleans, and I visit regularly. Once I even did a bit of building work, but all sorts of things. And then, as I said, I write, and my writing is a reflection on the world that we live in. And people creating a greater awareness of people, who they are, what they have to offer, and the challenges that get in their way at times as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good, you did a nice little summary of yourself and your approach there. I think as a rhetorician, when I hear explanations, that wasn't exactly a pitch. It was more of an explanation of what you've done and why you are who you are. But there's always like things will illuminate and they're like little pieces of it. And I'll be like, what's that? Or I'll think of the opposite, you know, as you start to investigate some of these concepts. So I like the idea of mosaic, which I think is a really nice central image, right? Yeah. You hear the word diversity a lot, but there's really no image with diversity. Mosaic, at least it starts in the art world, already has beauty infused into it. And I think it has a nicer feel to it than diversity.
Yeah.
Where'd you come up with that word?
Where did I come? It's my second book. So I've written three books. And my second one is Consequences, Diverse to Mosaic Britain. And I'll touch on the concept of the book. It started with an idea, as do most things. There was a party which you could call not conservative, some would call it a far right party, which was gaining traction in Britain, called the BNP at one stage. And a lot of people were on social media saying that they're racist, anyone that supports them is racist. And I had actually just met someone, I didn't know it at the time, but I'd met the person, had lunch with the person was talking about business doing business together. And then I realized afterwards that they're a member of this party, the racist party, BNP. And I started thinking, are they all racist? And that led me to do some research. So what are the challenges and concerns of people that support a party like that? How did we become the diverse society that we are, that some people might see as a threat? And how do we move forward? And in the moving forward, it was a matter of, we are diverse. That is fact. And that is not going to change. We're not going to become less diverse. That is reality. And where do we move from here? Something mosaic, where we truly appreciate who we are, what everyone has to offer, our common values, our common interests. So hence I spoke about diverse to mosaic. And that was about Britain, but it could be anywhere in the world. And most definitely it could, and it should be America as well. So that's how I came about the mosaic concept. And it's followed me through, such that I talk about developing a mosaic world. I want to change the world, not all by myself, but I want to change the world to develop a mosaic world.
Yeah, it's a central image that people, I think, can get around. Like it has has an art history and a beauty to it and a positivity to it, I think. When you actually get into diversity and pluralism and these concepts of culture, you know, what's happened to the world as the world's become more global and more transportation friendly and borders aren't as hard as they used to be, that this sense of, is it like, do we adjust to pluralism because it's a fact? Do people are they still hesitant and resistant because they don't want to adjust to pluralism? So do you have to do some type of persuasion with them to get them to understand the positivity of pluralism? So it can be negative or positive, right? Pluralism is just a thing, and you get people on both sides. And I think, like, a lot of times when people get into the racist parties and things like that, it really is a reactivity against pluralism. I used to say when I lived in Los Angeles, like, I don't see how anybody could be racist here, because every culture on the earth and race is here. Like, you'd be exhausted as a racist. You don't even know what people are.
but I guess that it's funny, because as you put it that way, that possibly reflects part of the problem, not knowing who people are. I know who I am. And for someone that looks like me or has something in common with me that I can readily see, that I can identify with that person. And something that comes in me almost immediately to play is trust. I learned that when I did some work with the fire service and spoke to firefighters who are supposed to be very traditional and very closed. They you go to a fire station and it's people working with their relatives. So you might have on a watch a firefighter working with his brother and his uncle and his father, and they're all working together. And talking to firefighters, what I found out and what one of them said to me is, no, we don't mind working with anyone. It's just that we need to know that you're someone that knows what you're doing and that you're someone that I can trust, that is going to have my back. And those people, their relatives, they know them, they know their flaws and all, but they know how they know that they feel there's a sense, I know this is familiar, I can trust. But when someone is different, then I guess unless you take the time to explore and get to understand who the person is, what drives them, what their differences mean, and at the same time, the things that they have in common, their common humanity, their values, they all have families and all those different things. Unless you really take that time, for some people, rightly or wrongly, it's their reality that they feel less comfortable and the trust isn't there.
Well, for sure. And I part of my degree was in cultural studies. It's always fascinated me, these big pockets of humanity that grow up in different regions and the things that infuse them, and the art and the literature and the approaches to life. It just fascinates me to move through those groups. But one of the challenges is, like, even within, I remember I use this story sometime to explain. I grew up in Kentucky as I was the first person in my family to go to college. So it was a working class neighborhood, very redneck, very, you know, just off the farm. My family was the first family off tobacco farms. And so I grew up around rednecks. Like, I know that culture. I know how to read them. I know what's safe and I know what's dangerous. I know what they're doing because I can read all the micro cues and their behaviors and the way they talk and their everything. And I was at a bar one night with a friend of mine from New York, and we were somewhere in Kentucky, and we were playing pool, and he was teasing these guys that were playing. He was just having fun, but they were starting to get mad. And I told him, I said, stop talking to them because they're about to hit you with a pool stick. And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, it's a different culture here. You've offended them.
Yeah.
But that micro read is so hard across cultures. You know, and I think that is the sense of trust. Like, you build trust because I can kind of predict who you are and what you are and how you're going to act if I can micro read you. But across cultures, it's really hard.
It's harder. It's harder. There is something about, there are things we still have in common.
And not in common. That's my, I think that's my thing. It's like, when you look at this concept, and I think you're pulling out clearly the positive sides of pluralism and diversity, which I think people do need to be trained to, right?
Yeah.
No matter what. And I think that's really important to amplify those. But to have a full conversation, you also have to, you know, look at it and say, well, like, if they were racist, this other political party, you're going to have to be careful what you're doing with those people because they have a certain element of danger and you need to know what that is.
I agree. But I guess what I was going to say is, I think most cultures, if not every culture, recognizes a smile. All right. Most cultures, most people have the ability to look in your eyes and see you and your humanity.
Yeah, that sounds, I don't know, people are tricky.
They can be, but it's a start. So I guess what I'm saying, you start somewhere. You have to start somewhere. So for me, it's a starting point of meeting a human being. And you can see I'm automatically smiling just saying that.
Sure.
And looking in their eyes and saying hello to the person. That is an opening. There's something big about a curiosity about the person and asking open questions to find out more about the person, of being able to say what you know and what you don't. It doesn't work with everyone, but for most people, they're ready to engage. People like talking about themselves and who they are. And we're naturally curious, even though it's often beaten out of us. So especially in that one-to-one small group basis, there's something about having the conversation to find out more. And it's a fascinating process. I like traveling to different places. Japan is one of the first places I ever visited. It's just fascinating and great people. New Orleans has become a second home to me. People say, do you have relatives there? Like, no, it's just, well, I could say I do now because the people, friendly, it's a friendly place.
It is. It's a very interesting, New Orleans is a very interesting place.
Yeah, but it's just that thing about the cute, I was a Y child when I was small. You know, that child that is always asking questions. And I was told, like most young people, stop asking why, just do it. but I refuse to listen. And I've gone through life asking why. And that's led me to do research, but it also means that I meet a person and I'm going to ask the question. I hope you don't mind me asking. I'm curious about this. Most of the time, people engage with me.
They do. And it's fascinating, like the power of, again, in cultural studies, the different ways of studying cultures, the power of questions, of ethnographic, deeply interested in somebody else's life questions. It has a real power to it. People react there to it very well.
And I'm still a believer in intent as well. To start off with, what's the person's intention? Some people might see that as soft, that no, you need to act or judge the actions. But I like to understand the intentions. Why do people do this? Why did you behave like that? And I believe if you understand the intention, it's easier to journey with people to where they need to be. And it's also easier to hold people to account, because I can't hold you to account to my beliefs, my values, my ethos. But if I understand yours, I can hold you to account on that.
Interesting.
And I say that almost as if it's a threat, but
sure. No, everybody gets worried when they're going to be held to account, right? So talk to me about doing this in corporate environments. Like, I know I have a lot of friends who do sort of softer work, I think the way it's defined, at least by corporations, with emotionality and like the pandemic and all the stress and, you know, psychological issues it's caused for people. I have a lot of friends who have worked across many modalities of therapeutics and instruction to try to help with that. And bringing that to a corporation, talk about your experience with that. Like, are there things you have to do to get them to open up to this, or are they already pre-warmed to an approach like yours and that's why they reach out to you? Like, where do you find the resistances and what do you do about it?
So I guess it varies. Every organization is different. And more often than not, I'm invited in by someone that knows me, or I've been recommended, or they've heard me, or they've read a book that I've written or something. So there's something that has made them believe that I am, should I say, a good person to engage with. I think in my approach, a key thing is I don't use the big definitions that I use so much these days that people don't necessarily understand and at times create barriers. So I speak in as simplistic language as possible. Sometimes I'm explaining a concept, like the whole thing, privilege has become a big thing. But I don't specifically say you're privileged. I might explain the term. So it's got context to it. So there's something about the language that I use that engages people. I am not judgmental in my approach. There's some things that I might think, gosh, you should know that. That is obvious. How can you still use this language in this day and age? It's where you are. I very much believe in starting from where people are, and that's my approach, as opposed to where people are expected to be. And you actually get to an end much faster that way. A lot of my work these days, over the time, I have gone in transformation, whereby I'm going into an organization. Okay, you're looking at performance. Okay, you're looking at challenges that you have with certain employees. You're not getting the results that you want. You're not being able to recruit the people that you need. And just focus on the process, the policy, the structure. What do you have in place? Now, my approach is much more conversational and information based. So it's a matter of what is the challenge as you see it, talking to the individual or the group, what's the challenge? So taking an example of an education institution I did some work with, whereby they wanted to diversify in terms of they recognized that they had the student body was very diverse. This wasn't reflected in the academic staff. And they felt, okay, the problem is at recruitment level, they're not attracting the right people to apply. So I'd had a pre-conversation with the HR director in the organization, and I had asked for some statistical information, which I analyzed. And so it was a matter of they sat down as a group and said what they saw as the problem. And then I showed them a couple of roles that they had. And it was like, well, this is what the information says, that actually you are getting people applying. 50% of your applicants were from these backgrounds. You only shortlisted 25%, but none of them were actually recruited over a time frame. And it's the same. It could be on any other subject as well, but that starting point of where do you think you are as a group? Let's talk about where do you think you are. What does the evidence say, whether it's internal data or external data? And then from there, let's take a pause, let's take a break, either that same day or coming back. And so now that you've seen the information, at times I like to use like the case study of a person who's had experience of working with your organization, an organization like yours. What do they say about their experience? Are they still there? Have they left? Why? So you've got the information. So now that you have, you know what you originally thought, you've seen what I could say, a different perspective or reality. So what do you think now? And what are you going to do? So let's work on a solution. So that way, what takes place, it's based on real information. And there's group buy-in and ownership into the actions taken from there. And that, to answer that question, also helps to minimize resistance as well, because what are you arguing with?
Right. Yeah, it's really hard. I tell people a lot with organizations and businesses of, if you don't have quantitative foundations to your arguments, you're really kind of in trouble with organizations. Because if you have statistics like that and you can show things, it's you can't beat that argument for the fact that this is at least a representative picture of what's going on here. We can talk about why and what you can do about it, but it's representative. I taught for a while at a small all-female college in the South that was Presbyterian. And a friend of mine ran a department there, and he brought me in. It was a new department, and he wanted me to help him build it. And this place was super conservative. It was super right. And I'm not. And it was almost an immediate culture bomb. I was the most liberal person they've ever had as a professor there. And it's like the whole place just went through these, you know, prop machinations of figuring out what to how to work with me. And I was in charge of the newspaper. So I gave the students the permissions to do the type of reporting that I would expect in a really good liberal oriented newspaper. And it just, they ended up threatening to disband the paper, and I had to do public hearings, and the student government wanted to have to, approve of all the articles before they went to the paper. And I'm like, you guys don't understand a newspaper at all, do you? Like, it's supposed to say things that rile up a culture so that the culture can see itself and make improvements. And just seeing what it's like trying to crush those two cultures together in that institution was fascinating.
Yeah. So what happened in the end? Did you, what happened in the end?
I left. I was there for 2 years and there was no way. I was one of, you know, an entire faculty that had been there forever, and they were trying to grow, you know, bless their hearts. They were trying to become something different because they had to survive. It had been an all-female college in the South all the way like back to the Civil War. They had supposedly ghosts of Confederate soldiers walking through some of the hallways, and they were talking about all these schools are starting to go away. And so they brought in new faculty to try to give new blood and attract new students. It was just too much, too fast.
Yeah. And it, I mean, I'm curious. I wonder what has become of them now, where they are, because young people typically think are more open. They're more exposed to the world. So they
depends see on where you are.
Different.
The South,
okay,
the American South,
okay,
has a lot of young people that are not exposed to new and want the new. You know,
well, that is true as well. Because I did, I did a lecture for a university in Chicago a few years back, and I was trying to talk to them about your place in the world, and I'd love to talk to those type of students as well, because my module was very much, who are you? What are your values? What's your ethos? So who are you? What do you stand for? And one of the questions I even asked is, what makes America great? What makes America the best in the world? Know that. But then it's what's your place? So knowing who you are, then what's your place in your local community, local world? At a national level, and then going on to the global level. So who are you in those contexts? And just in a similar way to I said with organizations, talking about, okay, this is the reality, this is, should I get a different perspective, a different reality based on data? I did the same with them. So these are going on in the world. Have you heard of this? Are you aware of this? Did you know that this disaster that happened in a factory, and a lot of the brands that you use, that their clothing and all of those things, and it was new to them. But I think the key was, it was journeying with them, and it was, I'm just presenting you with, so this is what you've said, what you believe, who you are, so, and what you want from life. So I'm just presenting you with some data. So bear this in mind, let it inform you.
Yeah, that's kind of with rhetoric is much more aggro about what it wants. It picks things and it's like, I'm gonna design messaging to get this. And so what you really want from them is a more open mosaic approach to life, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And you're going about it in a sort of soft information centric way where you're not challenging them directly. You're not causing conflict. Like you said, you're walking with them, which is a very viable way of doing rhetoric as well. It's softer and it's slower and it's less explosive, but it's still, you want to get them somewhere.
Definitely. That's why when I say, I start with intention, you could easily think it's soft, being on soft on people.
No, believe not at all. Me. It's just a rhetorical trap.
Yeah.
Once they set the rules, then you're like, you need to abide by the rules you just set. And that's a rhetorical trap.
Exactly. Because I am very soft spoken, but I am very intention driven. I mean, as I said, it's my whole life. I mean, it's what I believe. And so I am known for being quite firm. It's not always comfortable for me either, but there's an end in mind. So, and there are people involved.
Yeah, working within change, no matter how you go about that change with human beings, it's always uncomfortable. At some point, they're going to realize they're undergoing change. And one half of humanity and one half of who we are does not like change. The other half and part of who we are does enjoy change and growth and innovation. And so those are always at war. So you're going to be putting people into a dissonant space sooner or later in your work, right? No matter what, like you said, privilege earlier. And usually over here, that's got two adjectives in front of it, white male privilege.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you just villainized me. Like, I'm just sitting here and all of a sudden, and I hear that a lot. And I'm like, okay, let's look at the concept and what it does. Is it useful or, you know, for you and why isn't it? And that kind of stuff. I don't care what the concepts are. I just want to investigate them.
Yeah. But, and that's why, and you might say I'm marketing, but that's why I wrote my last book, which is male perspectives on the value of women at work.
Yeah. I think it's great. What a great title.
And it is very much touching on those subjects without specifically saying this is what we're doing, because it was based on conversations with a rich diversity of men about what they believe women bring to the work environment and what they see as the barriers, both from the perspective of how women present and the wider structure. And if you do that, you have to talk about men as well. Because it's men talking, they're going to talk about themselves.
Need change? Are you suggesting? Yeah.
But it was them talking, different perspectives that they had. But as they're talking about women, they're also talking about themselves. They're talking about the system and how the system works more to the advantage of men than women, partly because it was created around men.
Wow.
And partly because, and therefore they know how to interact. They naturally know how to navigate the system, women less so. And so that's the awareness. And it's not women. It wasn't me saying it. This is men saying it. So woman, read it, be aware. Man, read it, be aware. What are we going to do about it?
Right. Well, and that's, again, I think the value of someone like you and the depth of thought that you bring to it is bringing out all those micro nuances that they haven't really thought about. And so I worked in comedy writers' rooms for years in Hollywood, and they're almost all white male centric. I can't even think of, as I look back, I don't think there was a single, I know I never wrote with a single female in the room. And I think it was all Anglo too. And you get the sense of, you know, it's still a meritocracy. There are people who do it very well. And then there are white males who don't do it very well. And you're like, how did you get here? And it becomes nepotisms. Like, they got here because they knew somebody, and it's never a meritocracy perfectly. But when you add in people that don't do what comedy writers do, like comedy writers have a different orientation to the world. There's no morality in comedy writing. You're supposed to just find the craziest thing you can possibly say. And sometimes that's shocky and it's breaking taboos, and that's the pleasure of it. And then you extract what's useful for your product. But if you have to suddenly start worrying about what you're saying in a writer's room because it might offend somebody, that's a real issue in that type of work.
Yeah, and I have noticed that. I mean, I haven't watched it for some time, but I used to watch Trevor Noah, the social distancing show, which he started calling it because of lockdown, which was previously Jon Snow. And I guess was it Jon Snow?
Jon Stewart.
John Stewart.
different John.
Just different John. But it all goes back to what you're saying. And I think good comedy gives you license to say things that, it gives you license, or it used to, or some people think it should and some people think it shouldn't. But it historically gives people to say things that may often not be acceptable, but in a way that gets people to laugh and think. But I guess it's also about who says things, because there is the thing about that comes to play.
It's crazy,
as well.
All the things that come to bear on this moment. And comedy doesn't particularly do well when you take it out of its context and move it to somewhere else and start talking about it. Like if I'm doing comedy, like male oriented comedy with other males, and it has a certain context to it, you pull it out of there and you show it to the rest of the world, they'll be like, what a horrible bunch of people. Like, yeah, you wouldn't talk like that outside of that context. It's like I've done stand up at churches for church groups, and they're so sensitive to language and any type of obscenity or sexuality or anything, even conflict oriented in your comedy, that suddenly the bar goes way up for what you have to take out and what you have to avoid.
You were doing comedy in a church?
Oh, because anybody, basically, when you're doing stand-up comedy, anybody that wants to hire you to come in and do comedy, if they're paying enough, you're going to go, even if it doesn't fit.
but I guess that whole thing about what is acceptable and what's not, it's a challenge. There is that difficult balance to strike, because there is that whole thing about freedom of speech and it's a joke, get over it. There is that, and don't be so sensitive. But at the same time, I think we are becoming increasingly aware of how some of these things deeply affect other human beings at times. And so it's not to not say anything, but there's a balance, and I'm not saying I know where the balance is, because one of the things that I find funny with people that say, you're a snowflake, get over it, when it comes to another subject that affects them, they're the first people to scream and shout and say it's not acceptable. So there's a balance somewhere. Yeah. And I
no,
think
there's
that's
not a balance. There's not a balance.
Okay, like, there's not
there a balance. It's completely unbalanced.
I was going to say, maybe there's something in having the power of having different people in the room, that even if they don't find a balance, I'm an eternal optimist, but even if they don't find a balance, they'll get something closer. But then I guess you'll say you lose the joy of comedy.
Yeah, these are very complicated issues as public discourse moments. And again, comedy has different rules than drama or tragedy or crisis. You know, all the things that the serious world, the way that they handle issues, is very different than the way comedians handle issues. And those worlds don't mix together very well. Like when you take comedy and try to move it over into the serious, or you move seriousness over into comedy, like I tell people all the time, I write jokes all day long on Twitter. Like I have a joke idea, I write it down, I put it on Twitter just for fun, and my Facebook. And I typically on Facebook especially curate whoever reads it, because I don't want to offend people, but I also do not want to hear that they're offended.
Okay, so have you ever been counseled?
Counseled on my comedy?
Yeah. Because we have got that whole thing about people getting upset with what people say, and as a result, we're going to counsel you. Well, not counsel as in counselor, but counsel as in cut off. And it's like, we're not going to engage with you.
Counsel
as in counsel culture.
No, I've canceled a lot of people. Like if they say anything negative at all on my Twitter, I just block them.
Okay.
Or my Facebook, because I don't want a negative experience about comedy. Like, even if you think I've said something offensive, that's fine. The proper response is to not laugh. It's not to comment back to me. I don't want to hear your thoughts. That was not an invitation into dialogue. It was me throwing jokes into the world.
Okay. I there's
in
not
this
much
particular context, that's the way
okay
I
yeah in that particular context, but outside of that, I think, I mean, it's just like what we're doing now. Outside of that, you are very open to dialogue, but I guess there is a reality that at times, if you don't like it, disengage. You don't have to sit down and you don't have to come to my show, so to speak.
Yeah, it's weird too that we live in a world, and I think this is partly because of the power of social media to enable the audience, to give the audience power. A lot of literary theory talks about this in as far back as the 50s and 60s about the reader having power over the author. Like when you read, there's an interaction, and typically privilege has always said that the author has the power for what their text means. And they get to tell you and that kind of stuff. But reader theory came along and said, that's not really true. There's so many different standpoints, ways to read this. Just because you wrote it doesn't mean you get to say what it means.
Yep.
And you're starting to see this move over into things like social media and the broad general culture. So you take that philosophical position and now it's out in the world and people are warring about it.
Yeah.
And so suddenly everybody feels the potential to be judged all the time.
Yeah. And it's spot on. And sometimes you have to take the risk. There is something when you write something, when you do something, it has a meaning to you, but other people would take on their own meaning. You might write a joke or write a book, write an article or blog or what have you, and you might think white middle class or middle age will absolutely love this, and suddenly you might find that teenagers actually there's something in it for them that actually they're drawn to it. It's like you've put it out there. Once it's out there, you have no power over it. Your power was in creating it, and then other people take over from there.
Yeah, and it is like when you're talking, the reason I started thinking about this is when you said balance, that there's a culturally appropriate position that we can all reach, where we share power, where one group doesn't have too much power, where the unempowered are now allowed to have power. And it all comes back eventually in these cultural moments and corporate moments and everything else to power.
Yeah. And it's an interesting one, because there's certain things I could say with that. I mean, one is there's a sense of power, but how much power do you really have? And then are you using your power wisely?
I don't know. Are we?
Yeah.
You seem to be using your power wisely. You have education, perspectival power. You have things to say and ideas to give out. And you seem to use those in moral ways.
I hope I do. I mean, in fact, let me not say I hope I do. I do. Do I do as much as I would like to? I'm one human being, so probably not. Do I do things the way some people would expect me to do things? Are there people that are disappointed that I don't do this and you didn't say this and you didn't confront this? Probably. But that's where I think it becomes important to know yourself, to know what you're about, and focus on that and worry less about other people's points of views. Be aware, try to do what you do and follow your path, your beliefs, without hurting people to the extent that it's possible.
Yeah, right. I mean, when you're doing creative stuff and you're moving fast and you're trying to say sort of electric things in the world and you're trying to come up with new ideas, they're clumsy and they're not always refined and they're not always edited so that they're going to take into account every perspective. I run into this a lot with my 22-year-old daughter, who's very, very engaged with like the trans community. She was special effects makeup person and did a lot of trans makeup and movie makeup. And so she's got a lot of friends in that community, has hung out there forever. And she's very sensitive to things like pronouns and identity. And I'm like, I get it. Like, you've lived in that world for most of your life, really. I don't live in that world at all. Like, you can't hold me to the same criteria that you've developed, that sensitivity and the complexity that she has about it. I'm like, I don't know any of that.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I'm with you on that. Because it's why I talk a lot about people being on a journey, and she's been on that journey for a long time, and she's therefore got a fuller awareness that she didn't have when she first set out on that journey, which you can't expect me or other people to have realistically, because even the way I try to, the way I look at that is, if you think of a trans person, the person has been on a journey to realize that actually this is not who I am. I'm not living as the person that I really am, and therefore I'm going to make changes. I don't think anyone woke up one or the day that they were born or they got to the age of 5 and they knew and they understood and they decided. They went on a journey to get there. And so I dare to say that it's unrealistic to expect the people around you to immediately get to the place that you took years to reach. And that goes back to intent. So, okay, so you've told me this is where I am, this is what I believe, this is what I'm doing. I'm changing my pronouns. Be gentle with me, dare I say, if without ill intent I get things wrong. There's an actress, or not an actress, a singer, Demi Lovato, who's recently made changes. And I liked when I read one of their notices, there you go. she was good at saying, talking about intent and accepting, okay, it's taken her time to get, taken them time to get to this place, and therefore she's not going to get upset with people if they're not going to get upset with people if they make the mistake there. And then if people intentionally just say no, this is what you are, you were born as this and this is what you are, it's a different matter. So I think in terms of our power, I think we have the power to say who we are, to define who we are, to develop who we are. We have social media that we can use to create awareness with other people. But I would like us to be a bit more gentle in journeying with people to get there, and not immediately shut down people if they get things wrong, because it doesn't actually solve a problem. It just masks the problem. It hides it. It doesn't really move us forward.
Well, I think when you find good little, you know, good central terms like gentle, you know, I think that's something that people can go, yeah, I think that would be good on both sides.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
Complicated totally. Issue. Let's all, you know, take some time with it. Let's not barrage our way through it and just apply our beliefs to each other or our woundedness to each other so that we can get to a better place.
Yeah.
And for a rhetorician, again, if I can hit a beacon, if I can set a beacon on the hill that everybody can see and start acting towards that, that's super powerful. So something like the idea of let's all be gentle is a nice mantra.
Yeah.
And
the reason why, I mean, I said it and I agree, but one of the things that we've got in the UK that people have started talking about being kind. And there was a presenter who committed suicide. And before she'd done so, I mean, it's complete. She was a presenter on Love Island, a program, and I think there were problems. I don't watch it, but I guess there had been the press focus and a lot of negative focus on her. And all, I can't say exactly why. But after that happened, people were saying, be kind, be kind. But then that was them having empathy towards her, understanding her story. Then something would happen with someone else who they didn't have that same empathy for, and it would be attack that person. So I guess reflecting through us and talking, be kind, be gentle, but be gentle with, I mean, everyone, or as much as you possibly can. And if you can't immediately see the reason to be gentle or kind to a person, be curious about them to understand where they're coming from. And then, okay, if you come to an understanding and it's like, no, well, disengage, or then let there be consequences. But let's start.
Yeah, and I think this idea of, like, again, all these things complexify so quickly. Like, we went from gentle to kind to curious. So now we have three beacons on the hill for people to look at. And then you pull all this over into politics, and politics loves to break other people's beacons and destroy the conversation of the other side. So it all gets incredibly complicated so quickly. But it's cool when somebody like you has made her decision to work within this and keep as much clarity in yourself so that you can give that to other people. And that really comes across in you. Like, there's a clarity in you and what you're trying to do. And people, I'm sure, read that and can learn from that. And I'm sure you're doing good work with that. So
thank you. Appreciate that, Dan. Thank you.
Yeah. So super fun. Good conversation. I appreciate it.
Likewise. So have I.
Take a second and sell your stuff. Tell people where to find you and how to hire you and all that good stuff.
Okay. So you can find me, Susan Papoula, just in case you don't get the spelling. My surname is POPOOLA. So if you just Googled me, you'd find me. I have a website, an umbrella website, mosaicworld.live, and then you'll find the links to the various things that I do and my books as well, which the latest one, as I mentioned, Male Perspectives on the Value of Women at Work. I'm really excited about that and the impact it's already beginning to have. Amazon, Barnes and Noble, wherever, and from me directly. So
nice. Yeah. Awesome. Well, this has been a fun Sunday morning conversation for me. I appreciate you jumping on, and it's evening for you, but this is me starting my day. So it's been fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation and hope it's added value in some form.
Oh, definitely. Whether people, no matter where you're at on this stuff, I think the more advanced conversations and talking to people who work in this all the time, it's the only way to get some type of sophistication to it, which is, again, the whole idea of learning rhetoric. It's so that you get a better sense of how to use this to make good things happen in the world, instead of just always fighting unfruitfully with each other over the same things again and again. So,
yeah.
Well, cool. I appreciate it. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Everybody get out there and persuade some people, because as always, we're human. We need it.